Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes, tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, science, and a number of other topics on occasion. I thought tonight would be interesting to talk about what people usually expect as either heaven or hell as an afterlife versus what the afterlife is more like. And the reason for this is that almost everybody I talk to will say, mixed in with whatever they've read in metaphysics books or wherever their concepts of afterlife came from, if they have any, they tend to think more in terms of what the media has expressed, what has been written in Western books about heaven and hell. Sometimes what has been written about heaven and hell in books even from the Middle East and the East. But mostly it's been through Western thought that these concepts have been promoted. I'm going to go through some of the basic elements of what I mean by heaven and hell and the afterlife in general. And then I'll go into much greater detail about where the concepts merge and where they don't and how come they don't, because I think knowing why there is this misperception sometimes is helpful. I mean, it's a little historical, but it does put it in context and maybe explains for some people why things could have gotten jumbled up to the point where it got changed from what it may have been at an earlier time and correctly stated. So let me begin with the concept of heaven. Heaven, in most people's thought process, but this is not everybody, and certainly you may have a different thought than this. Most people believe that if there is an afterlife now, some people are on the fence about this, but if there is an afterlife and there's such a place as heaven, heaven is a construction of life after death, usually made by God or great creator or whatever the defining source may be. And this reward method, well, I'll call it that, is in actuality a substitute for people not receiving good things, goodness, during their physical life, but having suffered some consequences of inexplicable nature, or just having sacrificed in the name of their God. This is a pretty close description. Now, you might say, well, I thought heaven is just some place you go if you were good, you know. Yeah, but it isn't exactly like that, because if you're good, then why do you have to go to heaven? Why isn't heaven here in the first place? You know, you can get into a lot of questions about that. Now, that's assuming that the religion doesn't deal with karma and doesn't deal with the more complicated and sophisticated understandings. And many religions don't, or explanations, at least, of the afterlife don't. All right, so heaven has a kind of almost an ideal reward for those that are favored by the standards of a religion or a philosophy, usually a being, God, in making it better for the person in some way. Oftentimes, heaven is a place without time, or if time exists, the person just lives forever within the heaven. And then they usually end up in a state of some kind of perpetual bliss of some sort. Although it's hard to understand that, because the hollowness of many heavens, as presented in some religions, it doesn't give the opportunity for a rich kind of afterlife. Now, some religions have a kind of purgatory, a midpoint in between heaven and hell, where those who have not yet sacrificed enough or been good enough, haven't corrected their vices, haven't been virtuous enough, have committed certain, not mortal, but we'll say serious sins, or minor sins possibly, are not yet ready to be with the hand of God or the beings who are special and will live in heaven. And then if we look at hell, hell is for those who have sworn off their soul in God, if the religion or the belief system includes souls, and have dedicated their lives to destruction of virtue or light, of a dark wickedness, seeking power, control, oftentimes destruction over others, for one's intended benefit in this world. It's usually what hell encompasses. And hell is a place where people go to that are going to suffer for either an indeterminate period of time, an infinite period of time, or a prescribed period of time. So hell has different versions. As religions become more politically motivated, they tend to increase the emphasis of the severity of hell to frighten people into following the edicts of the persons in charge of the religion. So the concept of hell tends to move around more than even of heaven or even purgatory, because it's the one that gets the job done in getting people to consent and to acquiesce to the powers of a religious viewpoint and controller. This is not always the case, but it tends to be the way religions develop, and even philosophies develop, even if they're not necessarily considered a religion. Okay, so these are, I'm doing this very, very generally, of course, and there are many specifics about these concepts that we could get into a great deal about. But the point isn't really about knowing the concepts that I think have error in them, but rather in understanding how the error developed and what the afterlife is really about, which reveals so much more about God and the nature of human beings, as well as the relationship of souls to the human beings, to their human beings, and how that is part of the whole story. So, this is a kind of subject that, on its surface, seems to be almost prejudicial in one's explanation. That is not what I intend, but some people may think that. The problem with describing afterlife is that the afterlife in almost everybody's mind who is not familiar with some of the concepts in ageless wisdom or related subjects is based upon the need to have a simple version of continuation of life to reduce the fear of death. So if we look at what is the purpose of human beings having such a strong desire, I would call it even a glamour, major glamour, to want to have an afterlife. And it has to do with the way human beings are built. We have self-consciousness, and we have it at a level in which we can understand who we are in relationship to our Creator, if we choose that. And once that becomes our understanding, which happens soon after 7 years of age, by the way, so for most people, then the fear of death becomes something humans live with. Now, most of the fear of death does not become fully developed until the age of 14. But nonetheless, it starts to develop usually right around the age of 7 or thereabouts. And this has to all do with how the self is created from a personality that controls the person and then gradually becomes aware of who it is in relationship to other people and other things, and then eventually in relationship to what or how it came into being. We question these things because we have an awareness of creation itself and other beings, animals, below human, do not. They don't question their creation. They don't have an awareness, a sense of creation. And the closest they come to is, you could call it birth itself and death itself as a specific event, but not as a concept. So you're not going to find a bunch of apes, say, getting together and having sign language, assuming we taught them sign language and they could learn it, of course, about the nature of how they were created, the nature of that creator, and what it means to be born and to die. Does that mean that an individual ape may not have that consciousness? No, it doesn't. If an ape has an awful lot of contact with a human being, it can start to develop itself from the human beings around. So that wouldn't be a wild ape then. You know, a pretty, very tame ape, to say the least. And it may actually develop the ability, as one ape that I know for sure did, that after it was taught sign language, it asked the question, what happens when I die? Now, that's an interesting question. But the more interesting question is, why was I born? And what happens when all of us die? But at any rate, that's still an important question, and it does indicate some development itself, but this ape was taught sign language, lived with a family for like 15 years before it even came to that point. So, I mean, these are important considerations. Maybe it came to that point after 10 years of living with the family, but the point is it still had a lot of contact with human beings. And human beings then are become the masters, and the animals become pets, and pets have a different kind of consciousness. So it's possible your dog or cat or some other animal you have may have the beginnings of consciousness of self. If you want to read more about that, check out Chapter 5 in Licensing Meaning, and there's a whole chapter on how the self develops and how you know whether your pet has a self or not, and kind of interesting stuff, but different from what we're into right now. Okay, so it's because we have awareness of ourself and God, if we choose to. Even if we deny God, we have to have awareness of God in a concept form to deny that God exists. So you see the paradox of that situation. And that gives us a fear of death. So innately, human beings have the construct of fearing death. And the fear of death is not at the moment. Like an animal may fear death when it's about to be slain. For a second, it will have fear. But it doesn't walk around day and night postulating and thinking, well, what's going to happen when I die? It doesn't project that sense into its future. We do. And so, heaven, purgatory, hell, the afterlife, become subjects of such pronounced importance that they have been used to control and manipulate people by those who claim to have in with God, or something like that, and got the lowdown on what's going to happen when we die. And then they usually stack the deck so that the information that they have about what's going to happen fits their means of saying how we should live, how we should respond to our religion or to those that are coming up with these ideas. And it puts them in a position of power and control. It's a political issue. That, unfortunately, is where most of these concepts have come from, leading to, over time, a preponderance of misinformation. Even in the face of, at times, many sources is giving much better and sometimes quite accurate information about the afterlife, these misperceptions have stuck because the powers that are pushing on them want them to stick, and they reinforce them throughout their messages to those that belong to their sect or their philosophy even. All right. How does that fit in with my understanding, which is based somewhat on direct experience, quite a bit actually, and in addition to that, a good deal of other information, including those that of others who have traveled, so to speak, in consciousness to the afterlife, parts of the universe anyway. What is that? How does that fit in? How does that relate? Well, the interesting part about this is that the real afterlife, if you want to call what I'm going to explain as real, is so much more interesting, so much superior in concept construction and even the examples, and so makes so much more sense than anything else I've ever heard anyway. Again, I'm not trying to be prejudicial here. I'm trying to be expressive of experience and as accurate as possible for what I've tested of those experiences. It's so far beyond that for most people, their problem is in letting go of the much simpler and very inaccurate concepts because of the challenge that they think there will be some recrimination if they don't buy into these shallow, almost meaningless explanations of heaven, purgatory, hell. They think that in itself, if you don't agree, then that's bad news. You got problems. You're going to end up in hell just for not agreeing, you see. So there's a general fear about challenging the professed and contrived afterlife of most religions and philosophies. It leads to a kind of diabolical way of controlling large numbers of people, and even getting them to contribute time and energy and money, because after all, afterlife seems pretty darn important, and if we get it wrong, maybe we'll end up in a bad place. All right, so this is the definable problem that we're going to talk about tonight. These are the issues, and I think as I explained from a lot of different angles that I may not have mentioned in prior shows about afterlife in general, because now I'm dealing with it in terms of the specific issue. When I explain this, it should clarify and maybe even convince, although I'm not here to convince. I'm here to give information that helps raise consciousness or understanding. And if any of you choose to say, well, that guy's a nutcase and I don't want to hear any more about this, or you know, whatever. Maybe he did astral travel, but he probably came back a nut, you know. Or maybe he went there because he was a nut. Who knows? All of those possibilities are there. You can come up with that as a conclusion. I don't doubt that. But nonetheless, it's incumbent on me to tell you what I certainly think is as accurate as I possibly can make it. Going to the afterlife while you're fully conscious and still physically alive has the risk of experiencing things through filters in your own astral body and could lead to mistaken notions, or if you can make it to the mental world, in your mental body as well. So anything I say must be considered within that context. Although, I've gone many times to many different subworlds, and so the results have within them tests. And I haven't done it of late in terms of the astral world, because there's all kinds of consequences in terms of potential problems you can cause yourself. So once I got a clear understanding that was good enough to be able to teach, I didn't do it just because of, well, I think I'll do this today for whatever reason. So let me give you some of the concept differences. Started off with heaven. Heaven seems to be some kind of reward system in some religious viewpoints. It is a place of contact with great beings, godly beings, and God maybe itself. And it is a place where you spend either very long or infinite amounts of time with loved ones and others that deserve to be in the same place you are. Some religions focus on different levels of heaven. Others don't. So the levels being based upon the merit of one's virtue and possibly one's continued virtue while living in heaven. How does that fit with beginning with the astral subworlds? If we examine the most frequently traveled to astral subworld after death, it's the fourth subworld, which is right in the center of the kinds of subworlds that exist. They exist from the first to the seventh, with the eighth as a special kind of constructed part of the seventh that's made by evil. We'll talk about that later. And the fourth is it's a little bit more virtuous, the people are, than people are here on Earth. Now, how can that be if everybody there came from here? Shouldn't it be a replication? And the answer is no, because when we leave the physical body and die from the physical and the electromagnetic or etheric senses of the physical, we let go of the senses that have the most damage to them, the most amount of illusion in them due to the density of energy itself in this dimension. And that gives us a much more accurate understanding through our senses of the world around us immediately as soon as we reach the astral world in comparison to how we lived while physically alive. In addition to that, the physics of the astral world makes it easier to live there. And the people around us are more like us in same, similar homogeneic consciousness. Here there's heterogeneic. All kinds of consciousness of people live all at the same time in the physical world. The astral world, we have the luxury of not having to have the stresses of having people too far different from ourselves. There's advantages and disadvantages to that. We'll maybe get to some of that. So here we have an opportunity to gain in consciousness as soon as we arrive in the astral world. Senses work better, mind works somewhat better, energy is less dense, it's easier life, there's more people like we are, less people like we aren't, and we can immediately sense a shift in all that we are, because even our body is just way different. Energy follows thought to such a great extent, things happen, in many cases, as we think them to. That sort of existence has within it, for many people, a kind of heaven-like experience. No matter what subworld they go to, they may assume when they first arrive in the astral world, they're in heaven. Because whatever they desire, or at least most things that they desire, they can create for themselves through their own creative imagination. You imagine something, it comes into beingness. Now tell me, that is pretty cool. Now that doesn't mean there aren't real things there. Real in the sense that other people have exist there too, and they can make things. So there's some reality to the astral world. It's a composite of the imaginations of all the people who exist there. And sometimes it's not just people, it's animals and even plants. But nonetheless, to a, we'll say, uninformed person, no matter which astral subworld they visit, they're going to think this is a pretty wonderful place to be. It's not all that bad, no matter how bad they have been. They may think they got away with something, even if they end up in the lowest subworld, the seventh, and are thinking that everything's going their way, because whatever they want, they can create, and life couldn't be any easier. But there's something missing if you were to end up in the seventh subworld compared to the fourth. The fourth is where most people go. And when they go there, they experience a lot of people trying to better understand God and themselves in relationship to God. But they do so oftentimes by seeking to look better. They want so much to be spiritual. Because after all, they're dead, but they're still alive, right? So that's a big desire that controls a lot of their thinking. Whereas people in the seventh subworld, in comparison, have within their context maybe very little spiritual understanding. They may not even believe in God, although it's more common that they do. But their God has to do more with rewards and getting what they desired while they were physically alive and didn't, and now they can get it as soon as they get to the seventh subworld. So they think God is just a great gift giver, so to speak. They have a material viewpoint of themselves in God, in comparison to people in the fourth subworld who have evolved past that even while they were physically alive. And so there's a greater balance between their material and spiritual selves, with still a good deal of hypocrisy in them wanting to look better than they may actually be. Because how they appear to others sometimes is more important than actually how they live. And that's hypocrisy. Now, this sort of thing is not terrible. And since most people, not, I wouldn't say even the majority, but the plurality of people end up in the fourth subworld, this shows that they're going to have a more spiritual life in this fourth heaven, we'll call it, than they did while they were physically alive. And they're going to probably be aware and conscious enough that they aren't in the heaven they expected to be in. But at least it's a heaven-like place. They may not fully understand what God is either, because those in the fourth subworld do not have usually high enough consciousness to fully comprehend the nature of their creator from that perspective. It's still a lot better than those in the seventh subworld, or the sixth, or the fifth. How is it that the real afterlife is so much more explainable than heaven even is? in any known, that I know of, way of explaining it. Well, the answer is that one, in my belief now, is reasonably accurate. That's the afterlife as explained in Angel's Wisdom. And the other is almost completely fabricated with no details explaining any concepts. So that it's just made up. Now, it's one thing to live in a just made up concept while you're living physically on Earth and believe you're going to heaven or hell or whatever. It's another to be there for a very long time, but not forever, and misunderstand the nature of the place you're living. And hopefully we can, with shows like this and books and so on, we can all gain a better understanding, or most of us gain a better understanding of what happens after death. So, number one, we're not as afraid because we have this self-consciousness. And we realize that ultimately consciousness goes on without the body. The body is just a place to house consciousness temporarily in a specific dimensional format. You change dimensions, you change bodies, but the consciousness remains. And here's an interesting point. Any part of your consciousness or mind that is reasonably enlightened, it doesn't have to be even fully enlightened, will sustain itself and go on. It only needs to be about 60% enlightened. Will go on and continue to exist. The only thing that won't exist is the awful parts of us, the parts that aren't virtuous, that aren't enlightened. And I guess a good argument for that being the case is, who would want to keep forever a consciousness that was terrible and selfish? Well, the answer is, of course, people who are evil do that. But I'm saying for the rest of us folks, we don't. We don't want to do it, and we don't. So the only fear, if any, that could exist of loss of consciousness is loss of dark consciousness. But wouldn't you say that if you can keep all the enlightened consciousness you have, and you could get rid of the dark consciousness, that's a pretty good deal. And you don't really lose self that way. You lose some elements of your personality. The personality can be very selfish and controlling and nasty, but the self still can remain a good part of us, although there may be very limited amounts of it if the personality is so over-controlling. All right, so let's consider now the different subworlds from, we'll start from the seven subworld up, and talk about each in terms of heaven and the concepts of heaven and purgatory, hell, and how people change and sometimes adapt, and how they have to, at some point, respond in ways that are more real to the environment that they're actually in. Since what I'm going to be explaining to you tonight may be different from what you believe is reality, then just go along with it to see the examples of it and see where that leads you. And if you don't agree by the end of the time, that this just makes more sense. And if there's a God, it must have made it something like the way I'm suggesting it than the way that is usually suggested as an afterlife. Okay, we'll get to the eighth sphere, which is where evil hangs out later, but let's talk about the seventh subplane. Seventh subplane is a place where pretty darn selfish people end up going to. That's not the average folk. These are people who generally have lived their life by taking from others. They may represent as much as 90-95% of their life being in some way selfish, but not evil. Let me explain the difference. Evil seeks to destroy God and life. Selfish people, even very selfish people, seek to take from other life and to gain from other life, but they don't necessarily want to destroy other life. And they don't want to destroy God, because they usually don't think God exists, or if it does, it's some type of anemic being in relationship to themselves, and that they can get around all the details about God and continue to live very selfishly without consequence. Now, what do I mean by selfishness? Selfishness is not just things, not just taking things from others or finding some way to take things. It includes the misuse of power and control. It includes the desire to satiate one's feelings at the cost of others. And it also includes the need to be right and to seek without concern for others the ability to control their minds, force the thoughts of oneself on the attitudes and thoughts of others, regardless of correctness, regardless of lovingness, because they just want to make it seem to themselves and to others that they're right. The right is a controlling aspect, manipulative, and it feeds into the power of meeting the other desires of the astral body. So this mental stuff is really supportive of the astral body, not vice versa. Therefore, it's called kama manasic thought that controls it. Dark. It's not evil, necessarily. Those who go to the seventh subworld are plagued by all of these things to a very high level. Like I said, 90% of the time, they may live their lives in a fashion in which this is the predominant. These are the predominant elements that they try to get from life. If they believe in God at all, I mean really believe in, not by some professed statement to just get others to give to them something. But I'm saying they really believe in God. They believe in a God that is kind of like a mockery of God. God is some kind of being who really doesn't care much about what you do or don't do because you're insignificant to God. Now, why would they have such a viewpoint of God? Because that's their viewpoint of other people. And they just extend it to their God. So God is just like they are. Ah, well, that kind of makes more sense then. Right? So the seventh subworld has people in it that are inordinately selfish. They use and abuse other people. Usually they abuse the people who are losing their senses because they've been selfish beforehand. And as a result, they become victimized and suffer consequences from the folks who recently arrived in the seventh subworld and have better senses and better creative imagination and can force outcomes to be the way they want it to be. But as they age and use up their senses in such dark ways, they then become victimized. Some even become victimized by animals and even a few monsters created by the evil ones in the eighth sphere. We're talking about a pretty bad place over time. Here's the point. Most people who arrive in the seventh subworld, when queried by yours truly and by others, they firmly believe they aren't in heaven. Now, why would that be the case, even if you explain to them that someday they may become victimized just the way they're victimizing others and may not be able to get what they want because others will take, etc.? they first of all don't believe it because they believe God is like them. So God's not going to do anything to them. Besides which, they already are experiencing heaven. They are getting what they want for years, oftentimes. This is not a short time. It leads into decades for most people. And after several decades of getting everything you want, it's pretty clear. Got to be heaven. And when they see others and talk to others who have been doing this for 20, 30 years, they get convinced of it anyway. Now, you might say, well, why don't they talk to the people who are getting bad stuff done to them? Because those people are usually so senseless and so abused that they can no longer communicate adequately what's really happening to them. And so they're observed as some kind of almost thing rather than people. And nobody takes stock or notice of their plight. Wow. Okay, well, listen, we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to go much deeper into this subject. Should be interesting. So I will be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yeah, tonight we're talking about concepts of heaven and hell and purgatory or anything else versus the afterlife. And I've done shows, of course, on the general concepts of the afterlife, but not in comparison to what people expect and think, and comparing the relationship of these in terms of how it affects us while we're physically alive, because this is a big deal, after all. If we get this wrong, which most people, in my opinion, are getting it not quite right, we are preparing ourselves in the wrong way, and we're not understanding God either, and maybe not understanding good or evil and certain other aspects of existence. Those are pretty big things to not have a good understanding of. It's certainly not something you want to you don't want to live your whole life without correcting. So maybe tonight's show will be a step in that direction. Okay, so people that go to the seventh subworld have a pretty consistent belief for maybe 30, 40 years, some up to 50, and almost everybody more than 10, that they're in heaven. I remember seeing a Rod Steiger's, Rod Sterling, I'm sorry, Steiger's a different guy. Rod Sterling, Twilight Zone, I think he wrote it, where people thought that they were in heaven when they were really in hell because they got everything they wanted. And over time that got to be boring and kind of unchallenging. But that isn't exactly right either. I mean, it's an interesting concept and certainly could be an argument that if someone was going to spend forever in a place where everything that they desired immediately got, there was no challenge in life and life would become boring and tedious. But more than the tediousness, the seventh subworld and the other subworlds, as a person loses their senses, can be terribly torturous and destructive. Yes, there's some boredom. There's no question of that. That also comes about. So the Twilight Zone could be incorporated into the concept. But beyond that is the suffering from loss of consciousness. Because as our senses wither because we're selfish, and that's what happens over time in these lower dimensions, the other thing that happens is time is dilated, and we will spend a couple hundred or more years there. And that's a lot of time. 200 or 300 years in the seventh subworld is a long time if you're senseless after 40 of them or so. That could be a very long time. And what happens is if others, they'll victimize you. They'll steal whatever sense you've got left. You can do that in the astral world. You can't do that here in the physical world. And they'll also maybe take everything you have and use it and abuse it. They'll abuse a person in whatever way is worthwhile to them. And they certainly effectively enslave people. So just imagine you spend a couple hundred years enslaved, tortured, pretty senseless, with no things in your possession because you can't create them anymore and everything you have is taken from you. And abused in almost every way imaginable to the point where you're treated far less than as a human being. That's a pretty bad situation. Now, my question is, do you think it's punishment? Let me tell you this. Nobody that I know of has ever gone to the seventh subworld and is forced to stay there because of some being putting them in chains or preventing them in some way from leaving or changing themselves, even. It's all self-created stuff. Once you start losing your sense, you can't leave the seventh subworld because to get to a higher subworld, you need more consciousness than you can muster in order to stay awake if you travel through what is known as the tunnel of light to get there. And the results are that you never get there because you fall asleep before you do. You just awaken back where you started from in the seventh subworld. And so people trap themselves. Talking about another storyteller, Camus wrote a play called No Exit, in which people put themselves into their own hell by creating an impossibility of them leaving due to their own inadequacies and issues. Most interesting idea. And somewhat true. But it's not forever. The astral body has a life expectancy just like the physical one. It's not a lot longer, but it is definitely longer than the physical body. The astral body wears out easier because it's made out of astral energy and it isn't as resistant to the friction forces of energy battering it all the time from using your senses wrong and other selfish factors holding on to energy. But at the same time, the astral body lives still overall longer. First of all, because time is dilated, there's a lot more time to live in. But besides that, it lives a lot longer because there is less illusion, not more illusion, in the world around it. The energy that is bombarding it is not physical energy. And so it has a higher rate of survival, a slower overall decline. But it doesn't mean that a person, while it is declining, isn't quite miserable. So people do live. They live about, in the seventh subworld, six times longer than while here. So if someone, let's use a round number here. Let's say somebody lives till they're 70 here. Six times 70 would be 420 years, potentially, in the astral world, on the seventh subworld. And that's a long time. That's a very long time. Now, the truth is that they don't live quite that long. Because what happens is the victimization is more extreme in the seventh subworld than it is on average here in physical Earth, because we have laws and most people don't live under those circumstances. So it prevents that sort of extreme. So people might average closer to 300 years or so. Because they die earlier because they're so abused. But that just tells you that that is not a good life. Definitely not a good life. After, like I said, 40 years, man, things get bad quick. And life is pretty darn miserable for those folks. People come from higher subworlds to try to convince people of this reality. And sometimes they get through. Some people come from the higher non-spiritual subworlds. Some people come from the spiritual subworlds. And they try to convince the folks living in these lower realms of the astral dimension to change their ways, to become more loving instead of selfish, to use their awareness of what they have for the benefit of others rather than just for themselves, and to seek a better place to live as well. All come into play. And some people actually get out of it before it's too late. Because once you're virtually fully senseless, it's too late. There's not enough of you left to change the outcome. Now, let's make the assumption that God created the universe so that there's a seventh astral subworld. I certainly find that to be true. Is this a punishment? Is this meant to, in some way, force people to change? And the answer is no. God doesn't force people to do anything. God gives people choices. And within the choices they make, within the universe that God constructed, and the laws or rules and systems of how those sub-universes and sub-worlds work, we choose to create exactly what we get. It's just simply causal. The effects we get are coming from causes we made sometimes years before, but nonetheless. And we can always change those things before they fully strike us as some kind of terrible outcome by creating a lot more light with similar kinds of energy. Not easy to do, certainly worthwhile. And we're given that opportunity at all times. So it isn't such a terrible situation because we're not being truly punished by some great being that we have no say-so about. We're doing it to ourselves. We can change it for ourselves with considerable effort, but we can still do so. And it's not beyond the scope of any human who is not yet evil to change. We've got that option. And it's a pretty cool option. It's a great option. The numbers are not very great for those who live in the seventh sub-world who do change. It's somewhere in the 5 to 10% realm. I don't have a statistical poll because I didn't want to ever spend enough time in the seventh sub-world to get it exactly right. But it's something like that. 1 out of 20 to 1 out of 10 people decide to get the heck out of there before it's too late. And they actually raise their consciousness in doing so. But they have to first serve their surrounding inhabitants, denizens of their world. And sometimes they're harmed from that process, but they don't care because they're sacrificing. And in the long run, this makes them far more loving, magnanimous, truly good people who have resurrected themselves to a higher level of consciousness, oftentimes leaving to go to the fifth subworld, as an example, and being able to remain conscious there. Some of these folks, while they're changing, can visit for brief periods of time, like the sixth or fifth subworlds, but they can't stay because they fall asleep. Their senses just tire. And as you probably know, as your senses tire, you fall asleep. That's what it is. Sleep is a restoration of the senses, among other things. And it can only be done in a state of sleep when the senses are not being used. If they're being used, they can't be repaired. Not properly, anyway. All right, so we can now see that the people in the seventh subworld have opportunities, different than if they were in hell. They certainly think for a while they may be in heaven, and they're in neither. They're in a much more complex arena of interactional, consciousness-changing realities, where the grace of God is all around them, but they may or may not respond to it. They have the eventual opportunity to completely alter the future. And they do not have to stay in this realm indefinitely in any case. Fascinating stuff. Now, how often do people go to the seventh subworld to help? Well, from the spiritual subplanes, some people come. And from the third, fourth, and sometimes early fifth subworlds, people go to the seventh and try to be of some assistance. Most of the time, people in the fifth are going there, and they're still manipulative of others. Sometimes they go there to find people who have lost a lot of their senses so they can manipulate them. That's unfortunate. If they do it very much, they will get trapped in the seventh subworld and become citizens there instead of the fifth subworld. They're just unable to get back without falling asleep. Isn't that interesting? So not only do you have upward mobility, you have downward mobility. You can go in either direction. So you could go to heaven and opt out for purgatory or hell and vice versa, depending upon your own choices. This is a universe of choice, not a predetermination, not a punishment, but one of causal results. This is the universe that I love dearly because it is the most intelligent, most reasonable, most loving, most helpful, most godly of any I've ever heard of or could ever think of. Okay, so we've kind of got some of the really negative garbage about the seventh subworld. Seventh subworld people tend to want to have things. They want to have, even in their relationships, they want to have only a limited number of people that they have some either consistent control over, or they have control that's traded back and forth for a while with others. They seek to have things. They actually want to have the kinds of things we have in this world. They want an automobile or fancy this or fancy that. You might say, well, what do they need that for? Well, they could still, with the automobile they create in their imagination, drive somewhere if they want. They can do that. And some of them want to experience the life they either didn't have or they did have while they were physically alive. And they want to replicate it. It takes a lot of creative imagination to start building cars with your imagination and houses and fancy clothes and you name it. If you have to do that with creative imagination, your senses diminish rapidly in the astral body. If you do it every day, over and over, in years of time, you lose the senses, and then you're in trouble. And then somebody will come around and say, gee, thanks for creating all this stuff. I don't have to do it now. I'll just take what you got. And you can't stop me because I can get the energy around you to do whatever I wanted to, and you will be enslaved by me. So not only do I get your things, I get you. Pretty bad. Maybe I'll use you for some sexual exploitation. Not a good thing. All right, so when we get a grasp on this thing, we're going to see, wow, there is a lot happening here. It isn't simplistic. It's complicated, just like God is complicated. Parts of God, they're very simplistic. It's three parts of mind that all the universe comes from. But beyond those three parts, there's so much amazing intricacy. God is both simple and complex at the same time. All right. So I think we've got a pretty good understanding at this point of how heaven and hell compared to the seventh subworld, and any potential purgatory positions as well, middle positions. We are waiting for the eventual increase in light inside you. But maybe you have to be punished in some way. All right, so when we get to the sixth subworld, this is a subworld based mostly on six-ray energy. That's what we're talking about when we say seventh, sixth, etc. It's a type of energy that predominates. It's six sub-ray energy, all the energy in the astral world is of six-ray energy, but there are seven sub-ray types of energy in the astral world from one to seven. The six sub-ray energy of the six-ray energy is highly intoxicating because it's reinforced by the six of the six. It's a very strong energy. And it tends to make people very frenetic, to not want to stay in one place very long, and to be highly active, but in a less than intelligent way most of the time. So while those in the seventh subworld may want a car, a really fancy car, to go from point A to point B, those in the sixth subworld would say, forget the car altogether. I just want to go from point A to point B using my creative imagination and not even concern myself with cars. I don't need the thing. I need what the thing does for me. And so they have a different attitude. They create things that do things for them, but not in a replication of a physical way, but more in a truly astral way. It's closer to the true astral being, we'll say, because an astral being is not a physical person. It's a being who could recreate themselves to another location that may be thousands of miles away in a matter of seconds. If they can do such wondrous things, they can create whole houses, clothing, cars, anything, jewels, you name it, they can create it. But if they can create the effects of those things, such as having, being ecstatic about the jewels, or having a warm, fuzzy feeling about the house you're in, or maybe just having a lot of other material things, like tons of gold or whatever, those things can be replicated in what they produce in terms of feelings without having to have the thing anymore at all. So you get rid of the car because you can do everything with your creative imagination to replicate what the car was going to do for you. Now, some people will say, well, I still like to look at the car. Well, okay, that's okay. But it doesn't have to drive. It doesn't have to be a functional automobile. It could just be like a statue of an automobile. Maybe. Might suffice. The sixth subworld is a subworld where people want to always experience pleasure, avoid pain, and expend as little energy as possible to achieve those results. And when I say as little as possible, I mean that they would gladly use the energy of anybody else around them instead of their own to do whatever they can. That's true of people in the seventh subworld as well, but they're more concerned about it still having the appearance of a thing, whereas in the astral world, they don't care so much about a thing even existing if they can get the kind of, we'll call it, astral rewards that they're looking for in terms of their feelings. Wow. Quite a bit of difference here. How does that stack up with heaven and hell? Well, when people first arrive in the astral, sixth astral subworld, they believe they're in heaven. Yeah. The difference is that their heaven is far more interactional with other residents than the heaven of people in the seventh subworld. So life has a different tenor to it. It's much more in movement with others. People actually identify with the movement sometimes and with others much better than they might even in the physical world. And so there's considerable levels of collaboration. They can reach points where they actually cooperate to some extent, but oftentimes only as long as their senses are near equal, and therefore their consciousness is as well. As soon as one becomes much more conscious than another and much more aware, the opportunity for abuse and for taking from the less aware person becomes sometimes an irresistible urge. That's not a good thing. It produces a lot of negative karma. And it produces a lot of, we'll say, eventual destruction of your own senses, because you have to use a lot to try to control others. And their bodies are usually erratic and difficult to control on top of it, if it's in the sixth subworld. So we can see some pattern here. We can see how the development of these, we'll call it, super kind of powers is really a curse, because it uses up the senses and allows eventually possession by others. Yeah. Even others that aren't even in the seventh or sixth subworlds, but are in the eighth sphere. Okay, so do people in the sixth subworld sometimes leave? Yeah. And the percentages are a little bit better than they are in the seventh. It's still quite low, but it's a little bit better. And the reason they do is because they want to have more love in their life, is the most common one. It's not as sophisticated in thought as what I present on the show, and people aren't to that level of awareness or consciousness most of the time, but they at least have the thoughts of wanting to be in a better, closer relationship with others. That's somewhat godly. virtue is a little more touted. Not a lot, just a little. But it's enough to make a definable difference in the environment. There is considerable difference between the sixth subworld and the seventh. Because the people, animals, plants, but mostly people, that create it the way it is, are considerably different. One is dominated by their sexual center, which has to do with hearing when it comes to soul consciousness. And the other might be much more dominated by their solar plexus center. Wow, that's a big difference. And they're controlled, in a sense, by touch and what it feels like to touch instead of what it feels like to hear. It's in a different feeling that they get. Some are less selfish than others. The really, really selfish ones are oftentimes possessed on and off from people from the A-sphere. Wow. Now, eventually their bodies do deteriorate, just like people in the seventh sphere. The energy isn't quite as dense. It might take a little longer for that to happen, but time is dilated by more, by 9 times instead of 6. So when you increase this dilation issue, the people there have so much more time, their senses may decline even worse in some circumstances than those who live in the seventh subworld before they die. And that does happen. You have people sometimes so senseless that they can be used in any way anyone else wants to, but they haven't died. And they may live a fairly long time. Like 12, you know, you got into 9 times 70. Now we're looking at 630 years, potentially. Again, it's a little less than in the reality situation. But it's still a lot of time. And it's a lot of time with declining senses from 40 or 50 years on. That's a huge amount of time. Huge. If you go and interview people, which I did do, I was sort of the Studs Terkel. That's a guy who went out and did a lot of interviews for historical purposes many decades ago. But if you go out and interview people in the sixth, and particularly the sixth subworld, but somewhat in the seventh, and you ask the folks, well, do you think you're in heaven? If they've only been there 20 years, they'll almost always say yes. This is exactly my construct of heaven. But if they've been there 120 years, the answer will be likely very different. Such as, yes, I'm very fatigued. I now feel that rather than heaven, this is an experience to let me know that I need to change, because after the first 20 years, the remaining 100 has been nothing but misery and loneliness. And there's more and more people who are attempting to attack me and control me. So I can't really live the way I want to live. It's hard for me to correct the areas that I now recognize to be a problem. Can correct it, but it's not easy. So that is one of the hallmarks. People in the sixth subworld end up being oftentimes despondent. Depressions are pretty rampant there. Emotionalism is extremely high, more than it is in the seventh subworld, because of the density and the respondent correspondence of the sixth ray to the whole plane, and the fact that everybody is more emotional while they're astrally alive. It's a big deal. Wow. Certainly different from heaven and hell. Does it ring true to you? That's for you to decide. Of course, you'd want to read much more than I can go into tonight, but this is a rich series of subworlds that are like straining out the garbage that we accumulated while we've been incarnate. And gradually we're going back to our souls. It starts by living in these lower subworlds for some people. Not punishment. It's a way of justifying the effects of and cause that we created negatively on so many others. And it comes back to us. Over time, even the most hardened of terrible people in the sixth subworld start to regret their lifestyle behaviors. And they usually become more aware of God. It's an interesting process. If they haven't been possessed by evil, they have a chance of making some headway. They may not advance out of the sixth subworld before their death of that body. But they will or may have increased the amount of love in their genes, their spiritual genes, or Adam. Some people call it spiritual Adam. They will have a really great place to start from, hopefully, in their next life because they've cleaned out, they've created some more light in their astral body. They did it in the here and now while they were astrally focused in consciousness in the life there. As it is supposed to be. That's generally the way that it's done. Yeah. Let me give you a little bit of a break right now. I wanted to mention that if you do need some kind of medical help, you might consider Brandon McCarthy. He's a naturopathic medical doctor in Chandler. My doctor. I like him. And he's competent, very good guy, and he's affordable. You could give him a call and see if he's the right person for you. I mean, just go in and check him out. You can talk to him even. And in that process, you may find that he's the right kind of guy to go to. You can reach him. I'm going to give you his number right now. Even if you're outside of Arizona, you might have a question that he can answer for you. 480-557-9095 is his phone number. He's at 1949 West Ray Road in Chandler. And Chandler is right next to Tempe, where I'm talking from right now, even though the radio station is about 1,000 miles away. Isn't technology amazing? I know. It's really cool. Okay. So, let me also mention that if you haven't, I've given out the information sometimes about people that I think are doing good work. Sometimes the work has something to do with some activity that I've done with them. Sometimes it's not. But I did get a massage from a really great licensed massage therapist this last week. I'm going to go back to see her. And her name is Lisa. And she has a website. You can go to the website. It's soul2soulaz.com. And check it out, because I think that she is a person interested in some of the concepts of this show. Besides that, I thought she was an exceptionally good masseuse, if you're in the Arizona area. But I read on her website that she actually travels to the locale sometimes. She does more than just massage. Lisa, check it out. Okay, I thought I mentioned her tonight. I'll tell you more next week after I get my second massage. And it's some kind of package deal that's being arranged by a local school, so it's really a good deal. I don't know if you can get that deal, but you probably can at least get a really good massage. Okay, so let's continue on and look at some of the rest of the ways that heaven and hell are considerably different from the astral and eventually some elements of the mental world or subworlds. I won't be able to cover everything there. But I do want to get to the foundations of how these differ from each other. So far we're beginning to see that what heaven and hell are designed to do is really something of a more political nature and a fear-mongering issue for control over people because of their fear of death. Whereas understanding the afterlife through ageless wisdom, you overcome your fear of death because you're not going to die. And you got a pretty good understanding of where you might end up and why. And that it isn't some punishment. It's a result of how you've chosen to live. That's all. It seems more reasonable. It's a real loving God that creates this with grace, a God that's not destroying your life or preventing you from having choices, but giving you all the choices you would want. A God who allows its souls and soul creations, he incarnates us, people, to experiment and find ways to be co-creators with our Creator. It's a great system so far. But let's go on. People in the fifth subworld tend to be a little less conscious than those who live in the physical world in more first type or second type of civilized folks who are more educated, have more wealth, which is not a good measure necessarily of people's consciousness, but also who may be more conscious. So let's say more first and second world, I'm talking about our world, type countries, but not always is this true. And that's why I don't like using it, because it's very ethnocentric. The issue is not whether the country is poor or not. It's how a person chooses to live focused, either on themselves or in service to others. And then if it's in service to others, it's as persons or as souls. So those are the big deals. People go to the fifth astral subworld, usually have lived a very narrow existence while they were physically alive. But they generally were not nearly as selfish. But they oftentimes have a very conventional viewpoint of afterlife. And they take this conventional viewpoint with them to the astral world, and they recreate civilization there in accord with their belief structure. So to them, some believe they're in purgatory because it isn't totally heaven-like. Some believe they are in heaven because they think that's what heaven's like. And they follow the principles more often of their religion than do they creatively change to fit the realities of the world around them, because they don't use their senses very accurately most of the time. They even are afraid of others that are creative in their senses and may try to inhibit others from doing so. Unless those others just move away from them, which you can do. It's a tough thing. These folks want to be, quote-unquote, normal afterlife denizens. And they really want to believe they're in a heaven-like place. That's a common phrase they use. They don't think it's truly heaven, but it's heaven-like, and it's pretty good. They think they're going to live many hundreds of years. They're going to be able to do many things they couldn't do while they were physically alive, and they don't believe they're going to suffer greatly, partly because they know about the sense business, and they know that if they use their senses a lot for selfish motives, then sure enough, they're going to lose their senses. So to try to inhibit this from taking place, it isn't that they're less selfish, It's just that they use their senses less in their selfishness, so they can be selfish for much longer periods of time before they become senseless. Tell me, that isn't a nutty idea, but again, they're pragmatic in a sense, a little scientific, because they're causal in the way that they lose or don't lose sense. It's just that they don't see the relationship between that and God. They oftentimes have a disconnect and a hypocrisy, sometimes. Not as bad as those in the fourth subworld, but nonetheless. So here we can see how the concepts of heaven and purgatory or hell are being challenged by the people's needs to be conventional, because that's what it's about. It's convention. Even the people that radically live apart from the conventional people still live by a standard in which they act and think and talk the same way, so they're still being conventional along their lines of thinking. It's very hard to be unconventional, because in this world, subworld, because if you truly were, you might be banished from all places and have very few people you could have much to do with. Conventionalism is a defense usually to misunderstanding the situation you're in. And people truly don't understand the situations that they're in the fifth astral subworld. They barely do. So those that go there that choose to grow in love can leave, and some do. Majority don't. Some become senseless or near senseless. Generally speaking, they're not abused like they would be in the sixth or seventh subworlds. Good news, the reason they're not is because the whole society is very rule-oriented. It may not follow the same rules as the town next door or to the folks living on a farm some ways, but they are very much rule-oriented. And they don't generally do extremely harmful things to each other. That's the good news. The not-so-good news is they pay a terrible price in this reward of conventionality, because they don't grow very quickly. They don't overcome their fixed desires or glamours very easily. And they tend to stay the same for hundreds of years. So they are plagued by boredom and fatigue, more so than people even in the sixth subworld. Their boredom and fatigue comes from literally overusing the same sense the same way for so long. Yeah. It's a tough sell. But it is better for them, in their opinion, than living like those in the sixth and seventh subworlds, where people are downright selfish and hostile. It's not a good thing. I find it fascinating to me that they don't, more of them don't say, hey, let's give up the conventionality here and get on with living. Those are the rare ones that do that. And when they do, I commend them, because they can become great servers for that subworld, although many will leave and go to a higher subworld after a time. But it's just, it's amazing that they can, some can, make the shift. They make the shift, they usually end up in the third subworld, not the fourth, because of the masculine elements of the rays in the fifth. It's easier for many to get to the third. Not all, but it is fairly common. Wow. Talk about hell and heaven versus the afterlife. Totally different concepts, aren't they? The interesting thing is that on the surface, there's a resemblance. But as soon as you go past that surface, the whole thing looks way different. Because one, in my thought represents God's mind and its actualization in activity, versus this concoction of threats and fears, controls, silly things. That leads to an oppressive environment and a depressing one. Terrible. Over time, it leads to criminality, too. Very little criminality in the fifth subworld. That's the good news. Bad news is conventionality can be suffering in its own right and can be lead to just as many problems for some people. Okay, so those are called the single sense subdimensions. You can reach them through only going through one of the astral senses when you astral travel from the physical world. And it makes it easier to get to those places. Getting to the fourth subworld, which in three-dimensional space is actually closer than the other subworlds I've just mentioned, it's a little tricky. It's hard to do. Because you're going to be using multiple senses. And the process requires that the senses be in pretty good shape. So if you keep trying and trying and trying, you don't get closer, you get further away from actually achieving it because you're wearing out your senses. So this is one of those situations where heavily trying is not necessarily recommended for success. And that's something I probably shouldn't tout too much. But anyway, that's the way it works. And if we're going to be looking at then what is the bottom line, when it comes to the fourth subworld, it's really a place where people seem to be waking up. Conventionality is not the issue. It's creativity. Now, the creativity sometimes has in it a lack of spiritualness, real spirit, and therefore is kind of phony. But at least there's the attempt to be spiritual, which is not necessarily true in the other lower subworlds. Life is far more complex because even to get to the fourth subworld, you have to travel through more than just a single sense in the astral body. You have to join the senses together, and it's more complicated to get there. People do it all the time, of course, because that's it's still the plurality of people end up there. And that's a good thing, because it's a great place to be. Many people say, well, that's my heaven. Okay, I'll go with that. I mean, if that's what you think. What makes it heaven-like? Creativity, a lack of boredom, interesting communication, constant with other people, a tendency to want to learn, but not so much just intellectually, but also experientially, so that it becomes part of the person. A lot of real love, genuine love, some artificial, exaggerated forms of love, some hypocrisy, some insincerity in the way that people live. This is unfortunate, but it is as it comes about that way. And it's closer to kind of a heaven. There's less elements of hell in it. You see that? And it doesn't have the waiting for something to happen kind of purgatory issues. People have a more sincere and demanding and directed life. Well, why isn't it heaven? Because the nature of life to these folks is starting to become God as a co-creator with us rather than God giving us something. Be it grace or whatever, so that we can live in a better way by the gifts of God. Those gifts we're born with. Now the gift of God is the freedom to create ourselves into a new kind of being. And the help of grace. By going to the four subworlds, we just automatically have a much higher consciousness than we had before. So that's a great thing. And there's many people around us with a similar kind of depth in their consciousness. Four subworlds, starting to really make some sense for folks that can make it there and that choose to live there. All right, so what other elements then are there? Is there a hell? Are there hellish things about the fourth subworld? Well, kind of. The greatest hell is hypocrisy. Too many people, too much of the time, are living their life for the appearance of being spiritual instead of for the act and actions and interactions of spirituality. This causes them to miss what spirituality really is, to waste a lot of resources and time and energy, including sense, on silly things to try to impress other people with. And it demagogues and reduces their life down to that of like a trained dog or something. You're just going through motions to convince people that you're this person or that way or whatever, instead of looking at it as a true issue. True issue where you need to grow and to change yourself into a better being. So there's conflict. There is between spirit and matter. There is a conflict, and that's what the fourth ray kind of sometimes represents. And this conflict is all part of the fourth subworld. People don't notice it when they first arrive. But after about 5 or 10 years, it starts kind of burrowing its way into people's consciousness. And then it could take many, many hundreds of years to deal with one's own hypocrisy and that of others and work it out as best as you can. You may not go back to being perfect, but you can actually change yourself to do quite well. And this is the subplane where you see people sometimes jumping up into the spiritual subworlds from the fourth, not so easily done from any subworld below that. And with great difficulty, it could be done. Because some people really get it. They give up the hypocrisy. They want to live to co-create with their creator. And they want to help others to do the same. And they really see themselves and others as souls. These folk can sometimes leave the fourth subworld, go to the second, and remain fully conscious and serve there. And then they don't go back to the fourth except to serve others who may have remained. It's an interesting possibility. And you got the best crack at it if you've made it to the fourth subworld or higher. What about people when they haven't? Well, they're just going to have a little harder time. But still, there's this incredible grace that comes from God in allowing us to screw up and still succeed and still do rather well in some circumstances. Now the afterlife is starting to take on a much, much broader picture. Many more contextual issues. It is as complicated, if not more so, than physical life is. And it starts to have true, understandable meaning. It makes sense. You can start putting this whole thing together and saying, you know, this puzzle is really starting to fit together. It's an interesting picture of the way people are. And it makes sense that we actually live this way. But the question then becomes, okay, how far can you take the model? Can people leave the physical world and go to the next dimension, develop themselves as a server in that dimension, take out, you know, make tremendous sacrifices, and become workers of light, become parts of God? It's all possible. Because God made it that way. Well, that fits my understanding of heaven. You see, heaven is everywhere to be found in the astral world. It's just that the people aren't seeing it there because they don't see they can make the changes until usually they hit the fourth subworld. And that's the problem. But nonetheless, it's still possible. And the fact that you're given the opportunity to tremendously improve yourself and move on is great. That's a fantastic, fantastic advantage. So I consider all of these heavenly places, in a sense, but they also have a hell to them. Because if you don't respond to your own godly nature and that of those around you, and if you don't try to love those that are there and others as well, you can get caught, and then it can become hellish. The hellish part of the fourth astral world isn't that people are going to rape you or do anything terrible like that. It's that you can isolate yourself into living a life solely for the appearance or appearances, and then you hang around with people who do the same thing, and your whole life is shallow in hypocrisy. That's very painful as the years go by, and the decades, and even the centuries. Wow. Yeah. It's a tough one. Now, moving to the third astral subworld, people have a more knowledge-based society. They're usually heavily into concepts, into thinking. And they actually have a strong conceptual understanding of God. Now, what is that? The general consensus is that God is a being, that one-third of it is involved in intelligent activities, which is, by the way, correct. And if one were to create a life of intelligent interactions with themselves and everything and everyone else around them, they would be both in God's grace, and they would be able to experience God as God really is. Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's not unfactual. The problem is that they fail to see the element of service and the element of balanced love with knowledge that others in higher sub-dimensions might. So they get confused. They think that intelligent actions in and of themselves creates a life of extreme virtue and extreme connection with God. Well, that's untrue. We know that's untrue. Many people have incredibly good foundations and understandings of the topics I talk about in this show, and they're miserable. They're miserable because they are not living a life connected to God. They're living a life connected to their fictitious semi-understanding of God being this being who at least one-third of is intelligent action. How do you get over that? Humility is the answer. People in the third subworld have to live with a great deal of humility, and sometimes you don't develop it until they get much older, and they lose most of their senses, so they can't use the technologies of their society. And boy, do they have technologies. Things that we use today, they invented hundreds of years ago in the third subworld. So they're way ahead of us. But they're still going to be us. I mean, they're going to, someday they'll incarnate back to physical form and the whole thing. Wow. So the problem here is that they have arrogance and egotism. They mistreat people who are more loving than they are, but not as knowledgeable. And they, in all honesty, have not developed the true nature of a soul, which is to be humble. Humility means that you assume you're wrong in the face of any contradiction in thought. Your thought's wrong, not the other thought. Gives you the opportunity to determine some level of truth. But the most important truth is that by being humble, you always win. And if you're not humble, no matter how right you are, you always lose. Because rightness is not an attribute of God. it's a desire on the part of people because it makes them feel more alive when they're afraid of death by being right so often. Of course, it's nonsense. It's an illusion in itself. Rightness or wrongness doesn't change the nature of the universe around you, but for some people, they believe it does. They may not even believe it consciously, but they believe it on a gut level, and that's what really gets counted. So, looking at it from that standpoint now, the third subplane folks oftentimes consider that they don't believe very often that there's heaven or hell. What they tend to buy into is that the answer to all things is knowledge, obviously wrong, and that their pursuit of it is an example of perfection in terms of being able to accurately depict or define any reality of form that they live within and that they experience. Wow. This is where the third subworld diverges from both heaven and hell into its own construct of a kind of, we'll say, not enough loving for the amount of sense that they have position. Actually are more loving than people in the fourth subworld. You just wouldn't know it because they are not loving up to the level that they are capable of creating soul love with. And if you don't have a soul level of love at these higher levels or subdimensions, it's harder to function with God in mind and in spirit. Difficult to do. So, in looking at the five material subworlds, they all appear to have some problem. But the problems they have are considerably different from the concepts of heaven, purgatory, and hell. They have to do with a person creating their own reality in a dimension of time and space where they're given free hand to do so. They aren't punished by reducing their creativity and freedom, only by giving them more, if they choose to take it. Wow. Okay. I want to talk briefly about the A-sphere. The A-sphere, evil has taken a small section of the seventh sphere and converted it to their own A-sphere, which is twice, well, I should put it like this, it has half the light that the average is in the seventh sphere. Half the light. That is significant because light is God's own thought. So half of God is completely gone from the eighth sphere. These are evil dudes. They have managed to get rid of one half of God. Holy cow. Dangerous. Place to be. And they do terrible things. They victimize people in the seventh and sixth subworlds. They use them. They're sometimes the people that do all the bad things, and not all of them. They have other people who work for them in those subworlds. Sometimes they don't leave those subworlds. They stay in the eighth sphere, or sometimes they will go to the sixth or seventh. But they are seeking to do this to gain power from other people's senses and other people's actions. It's a terrible place. And they may live for very long periods of time because they manage to crystallize their bodies and senses in a form in which they don't need to use much consciousness to function. They just need a lot of creation and power, and their creations are sometimes abominable and terrible. They do terrible things. Aren't very many of them, but there's enough to do a lot of bad. Are they in hell? No, because their torture doesn't begin until those bodies of crystallization actually break. And that can take tens of thousands to 100,000 or more years. So they think they're immortal, but they're not. Because once their body breaks from the crystallization, they have to go back to a form of life, whatever it might be, with their own consciousness still being semi-human. And they got to go back and live like a worm, or a flower, or a toad, or a fish, or a bird. So they go back and live countless lives as these animals with the consciousness of a human, or near consciousness of a human being. Tell me that isn't pretty nasty. You know. It's a sort of hell. It isn't a hell that's been explained very well by any of the sources. So in some ways it's hellish. In other ways, they might think they're just fine where they are. But in either case, it's not a great place to be. There are two spiritual subworlds, and in those subworlds, people are actually living a heavenly kind of existence. The second subworld is where they live an existence that is in and out of being aware of and co-creating with God. And sometimes. Whereas in the first subworld, they're almost always in tune with the purpose of God. They live some of their purpose in themselves, and they're very creative. It doesn't mean they're perfect, but it does mean that they have a close connection to their creator, and they experience heaven the most. Heaven in the sense of being with God, if that's what you think heaven is. They experience something far beyond that. They become super creative beings of service to all those who live in the astral subworlds. They involve themselves in trying to be saviors in some circumstances. They do tremendously good things. Now, tonight we're not going to have time to go through some of the differences in the mental world, but that's not such a big issue anyway, because most people aren't going there for a long time. If you're still physically alive, your next stop is one of these astral worlds, and you're not going to heaven, and you're not going to hell. You're going to a meeting with your creator of time and a discovery of who you really are, which is a soul. This whole process is a journey back to your soul and back to understanding God, which you've forgotten because of the illusions of life in the physical world and some of the lower subworlds of the astral plane. Hopefully this has given you some changes, we'll say, and understanding what the heaven versus hell versus afterlife is and why they really don't match up all that much. I hope you'll read some about the afterlife and come to your own conclusions so that your fears will become a means of finding even greater joy in the future. Well, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.